Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about Chinese economy. As usual, I'm with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia, how are you?
I'm really fine, thank you, Yu Yun.
We're also glad to have with us today Abigail Vasselier, who heads the foreign relations team at the MacArthur Institute for China Studies, one of Europe's foremost authorities on China's international strategy. Nice to meet you, Abigail, and welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thanks for having me.
Our Zhonghua Mundus podcast and newsletter are outputs of China Horizons, dealing with the Resurgent China, a high-level international consortium composed by various European research centers and universities, where both Bruegel and Marex are a part of. The consortium brings together some of the best researchers on Chinese affairs in Europe, working in a synergetic way to build up a world-class independent knowledge base on China in Europe. Alicia and Abigail have started a new project to look at how the new EU Commission should deal with China. They assess the new reality of EU-China relations and try to find ways to make it work for both sides, although with full awareness of the constraints. Abigail, could you walk us through how the EU-China relations have evolved in the past 5 years?
Look, Yuyun, the EU-China relations have completely changed, and it has completely changed due to the COVID pandemic, due to the war in Ukraine. And I think we have reached the point where China has become this main issue when it comes to thinking about the future of European security, when it comes to think about the European prosperity, Europe digital future, and our capacity to provide a sustainable future to our citizens. And I think this concept of thinking about China as a cross issue across all areas that will have an impact on our future, this is very new. And that is why this change in the Commission and this idea that we are at a moment of rethinking our policy vis-a-vis China, this is quite good, because it's coming up at a juncture where we need to rethink extremely quickly about what are the challenges ahead. So there is this sense, and we are coming to a point where we need changes. We need these changes fast. We don't have much time. That's why building on the work of the previous commission to actually think what needs to be done now, what needs to be done in 2 days, and what needs to be done next year, I think that's key.
Alicia, under this new reality, what does Europe want from the EU-China relations, and what should the EU expect from China?
Well, I think we have a position on China since 2019 where we say what we want. That's what we call a trinity, maybe not impossible yet, but difficult trinity, from cooperation to competition to rivalry. And that in a way describes more or less where we stand with, but this was written before the pandemic and before especially the Ukraine war. So I think now in what we want, I think we first need to acknowledge that China could be a threat, but I don't think we can fully say it is already a threat, but we see the threat coming from basically the support towards Russia regarding the invasion of Ukraine. So that is a new angle. And that changes a lot of things because it makes the rivalry aspect more real, which was there, but it was hard to pinpoint what we meant by rivalry. Competition was the word for competing in export markets and so on. But that competition is becoming more of a rivalry. Why? Because we have huge industrial policy in China. So, you know, it's like competition supposedly is fair competition. But the minute you start acknowledging it's less fair, you go to more into more consequential terms, rivalry, etc. And the threat is really, to me, hardcore security, not economic security, so far, at least. So, you know, what I'm trying to say here is that what Europe wants from China now is, sorry to say, less. Why? Because the areas of cooperation are smaller. Therefore, we need to realize that engagement in the sense, I engage in many, many areas, we're both on the same planet. In a way, yes, you can call it engage, you can call it a coexist, you can use whatever word, but it's less intense contact-wise. That doesn't mean we should not try to have contact with China, but we need to realize that there's too many areas where we disagree, which are reducing, indeed, the cooperation. And to finish here, what we thought in 2019 has tilted in a different direction, where engagement, cooperation is just much smaller.
So you mentioned on the side of security and then on the side of competition, it might be hard for EU-China to continue this cooperation because of the changes of realities. But then could you name maybe some of the areas that you still see there's chance in cooperation?
Well, these areas are relevant for the whole world, but because China is so important, China stands out. But I wouldn't say it's like specific cooperation, if you see what I mean with China. So climate change, of course, China is the largest emitter, so it makes absolute sense, let alone the fact that China is the largest producer of green tech. So on the solution and on the problem, you have China overwhelmingly present, yeah? But that doesn't mean it's a specific China-EU relation, if you see what I mean. It's a global issue. Same with pandemics, or same with ecology, or, you know, beyond climate change. So these are not special issues. The special issues are shrinking, say, scientific cooperation. This was a special issue, but it isn't no longer a relevant cooperation. The cooperation that is left is a global cooperation where China plays a humongous role. But it's not a EU-China-specific cooperation.
Right. So Europe and China will still work in some ways on the world stage, yes, but it's exactly. Not specific how EU and China will deal with this. Yes. It's on the issues that where everyone has to take their part in. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. And how do you think China will respond to EU's rethinking of our strategies against China? And what reactions or countermeasures should the EU anticipate? Maybe I'll start with you, Abigail.
Yes, I think in your question you pointed out a strategy against China, and there is not going to be a strategy against China, and that's very important. And it's part of what shall we expect as well. Alicia made a point about this capacity for Europe to still have the door open to China, to basically be able to say there are going to be global challenges, there are going to be regional crises. We see it all around the world right now, where we expect China to play a role according to this level of responsibility that we expect a United Nations P5 member to have. On top of that, I'd say I'd add a different dimension, which is here we are sitting in Brussels, we're having these conversations here, but we have 27 member states that have kept a degree of cooperation with China at the granular level that we need to computer in. So this idea that we are going to rethink both the offensive aspects of our agenda vis-a-vis China and the defensive one. And these two pairs up together. And yes, there will be a reaction. China is not going to wait for the EU to change and not react. But we have already entered that phase. We experienced it on the conversation on electric vehicle, where we had, in a way, the first tit for tat. And this idea that tit for tat are going to become the new normal in our dealings with China needs to be clear for everyone. We need to start understanding what is going to be the Chinese reaction, for us not to be driven by fear, and for us to have the capacity to deal with tit for tat at 27. Because when we do not deal with things at 27, then we have what happened in the case of coercion against Lithuania. And I think what Lithuania taught us is that we need to think about Chinese reaction and countermeasures on a systematic level. Yes, we have an instrument called the anti-coercion instrument that is here to basically trigger a response at 27, but this is not going to be enough. This idea that there would be escalation and de-escalation phases with China from now on, we need to think that through.
You mentioned there might be two reactions coming from China. One is more offensive side and one is more on the defensive side. Could you perhaps just elaborate a bit?
So I think from China, we need to understand that from a Chinese perspective, Europe remains a key trading partner.
that is here to achieve its objective domestically. Basically, if China wants to upgrade its supply chains and go up the supply chains, it does need technology, it does need talent. And for that, Europe is needed, especially since we are going to have a closure of the US when it comes to talent acquisition, when it comes to technology transfer. It does mean that China is going to turn its efforts towards Europe, both on a very charming offensive, as we are experiencing right now, but also on a very offensive one. And this we also need to be ready for. Chinese investments in Europe are also showing that China is becoming strategic vis-a-vis Europe. And this is also something where we are likely to see becoming more of a new aspect of China's strategy vis-a-vis Europe.
Alicia, do you want to add on to this?
Yeah, I fully agree with Abigail. I think two things to realize. Yes, China is in this game at the moment of scaring Europe because Europe is using its not only WTO anti-subsidy investigation, which we know about, but also its full defensive toolkit on trade, foreign anti-subsidy legislation, so basically EU-level legislation. And probably China never thought we would go all the way to actually using these tools, yeah? And we have, of course, the procurement, international procurement. I mean, there's a lot of things happening at the same time. And China is giving hints that it can, of course, leverage on its own, basically retaliate on many aspects. But what is interesting is that the reaction, frankly, even member states, is quite limited. Maybe they have not gone all the way to internal combustion engine cars being imposed a tariff upon in China. Maybe, you know, pork or dairy products are not so scary. But frankly, I still think that there's this sense that it's unavoidable. China is going to retaliate. So in a way, Europe this time was ready, you see, because we've seen previous retaliations. Like, and therefore, I think China is a little bit confused by the fact that we're not reacting to the reaction. So that's, I think, where we stand. But it also shows that Australia, I mean, many European officials have gone through the story of Australia just to see that it didn't really work. I mean, Australia has a different trade pattern than Europe, but eventually it didn't really work. So there's this sense that, okay, you know, this is unavoidable. And I think that's quite important because it puts the conversation at a different level. Yeah, it's like there's this idea that there's no way back. There's no return from where Europe already is. And also, I think it's very important to note that compared to the rest of the world, Europe has been quite reasonable because this WTO compliant, supposedly, countervailing duties on EVs are so limited compared to Canada. We just had Canada 100% following the US, Turkey 40%, you know. So it sounds like, well, it's bad, but it could be worse. So for me, we're at a point, I like Abigail's sentence, that we're not in a trade war, we're in a reality check. Because the whole world is doing this. Just that Europe is doing it in a way more, like I would say, more calibrated, or I wouldn't say more professionally because I don't have any doubts that, but more transparently. So it's hard for China to go full win, full Monty, because then what do you do with the US? What do you do with Canada? Yeah, I mean, if the EU is doing this and you go all over the top, what do you do with Canada? You don't let them in the, you know, like because everybody's reacting. There is a problem of overdoing it with Europe because then you have no instrument for the rest. So that's a little bit helping us in this difficult moment.
But I think just to add on what you were saying, when you think about the Chinese experience of retaliating against the European Union, it systematically backfired. The sanctions following the human rights sanctions over Xinjiang, when China retaliated in a disproportionate fashion, it completely killed the comprehensive agreement on investment. So the lesson was, I think, from the Chinese side as well, this disproportionate retaliation played against us. Yeah. In the case of Lithuania, I think from a Chinese perspective, it was exactly the same. We are going to punish, to basically exert pressure
to basically make sure that Lithuania adjusts its policy. Conclusion, they had a show of solidarity by the EU 27 member states. They had countermeasures brought by the Americans, the European Union to support Lithuania to stand up for it. So systematic backfiring.
And the anti-coercion mechanism being fully in place without Lithuania maybe wouldn't have happened. So yeah.
In one discussion about this upcoming paper, you also mentioned the need to think beyond the World Trade Organization when you're talking about trade disputes. Would you like to talk more about that? Like, how do you think?
You picked the most, I love it because that's a thorny issue. But, you know, I know this is, we're sitting in Brussels. I mean, you just can't say this in Brussels. But
Abigail is based in Berlin, so yes. Maybe.
Yes, it may be not even in Berlin, I'm afraid. But I think we need to, as Europeans, I'm going to be very frank and maybe emotional here on this topic, but we're Europeans. I know we love trade. I know we've had enormous welfare gains from trade. I'm an economist and I'm trained as an orthodox economist. But I've moved in my career to a point where I realized that sometimes you hit the wall. And when do you hit the wall? You hit the wall not because what you were doing was wrong, but because the world has changed. And you have to acknowledge that what still, even if you believe that's the first best, if nobody follows you in that belief, there's just no way you can keep that dream. Because by now, believing that the WTO will protect us as it used to be, it's just not real. So for Europe, it's very important to understand that, and this brings me to Abigail's call for emergency. You know, this is urgent. We need to realize that as much as we like a formal reality, if that reality is not real, we need to move on. We don't need to dispel that reality, but we need to build on alternative realities, complementary realities. That could be an alliance of the willing to have a different norms within the international trading system, which might not be accepted by everybody. But, you know, the WTO, when did China, let alone the ex-Soviet Union, or Taiwan for that matter, jumped on the WTO? Well, first, when the Soviet Union collapsed, I mean, the WTO was different before. It's not that the WTO has always been there in the same form. And I think we are losing the historical perspective of how we ended up in a very sweet spot, which, however, isn't there anymore. Thus, we need to go back to what was the WTO before? It was a different institution. Do we prefer something or nothing? We are not here to tell Digitrade or anybody else in this city how to do this. But we're here to remind the audience that this is a thorny issue, that Europe is losing market share as we speak everywhere in the world. And why? Why? Because not everybody plays with the same rules, even if formally they're there. And I think we need to acknowledge that and come up with some emergency measures, maybe. Okay, we still believe in WTO, fine. But for the time being, can we have something else to work on with partners which agree with let's call them temporary, like countervailing WTO solutions, if you want. Not permanent, but at least something we can work on. Because I think otherwise it will be very hard for our industry to survive. We need to realize this.
So instead of calling a stop sign, you're just proposing the idea to think beyond this system and then to explore other options that we have out there.
And we don't need to dismantle anything. We just need to continue. I mean, like every formal institution, how many institutions are there which do not work? And we know they don't work. I mean, okay, but at least people recognize they don't work and they move on. And I think we're not doing that.
And I think in the paper, what we do is not necessarily to call for the end of the WTO, right?
Yes, that's very important to clarify here.
And you say it in your question. It's about thinking beyond. And I think what Alicia just said is this idea of complementarity and bringing together a coalition of countries, of trade blocs that would agree that we need to think beyond. I think that's key. Having said that, it comes with tons of challenges, and people are going to tell us, you're on this very round table drinking coffee and speaking on a mic. It sounds very easy. And this is not something we are saying. This is not a very easy conversation. It's going to be very difficult if we want to do it all together with a very large number of countries beyond the like-minded countries with which we would speak the same language when it comes to rules, norms, and standards. And I think what we have experienced over the past years is this capacity for the EU to come up with norms and standards where we lose the global south. And this battle over the EU to remain connected to this very large group of countries which economically are very different, are at a different stage, that's going to be a key challenge. But I think as Alicia and I are only China experts, we are going to stick to talking about China.
Thank you very much for that, Abigail. And this brings me naturally to my next question of the constraints that Europe faces while dealing with China. I think we also mentioned a bit earlier, you said that the EU has 27 member states, so there's the coordination issue, and then also thinking beyond EU and China, there are other parts in the world that might also add constraints to our way of dealing with China. So maybe could you just elaborate a bit on that?
Yes, of course. I think, okay, one of the constraints, we just discussed it, and this is our orthodoxy over the WTO and the complexity to think beyond. That's one element. You said we are dealing with 27 member states. And I think if you take the relations of the European Union with a smaller country with which trade relations are much more, much smaller, I think it's very different than when you think about China. China is Europe's second trading partner. All the member states have intense, in-depth relations with China. Our degree of interdependency is such that our member states, they do compete for Chinese investment in their respective countries. They compete in China on the Chinese market because this is a unique market. There is just only one China. And in that sense, we are asking the impossible mission to reconcile, coordinate and create coherence with 27 actors that have diverging interests. And this is, in a way, China is a pretty unique case when it comes to that. So that's one element. And it means that the work around coherence, coordination, unity, it's on one hand, it's very challenging, but this is the basis and the framework of any successful European policy vis-a-vis China. Because when you think about the best moment of Europe's capacity to pushing its interests vis-a-vis China, so the high point of what we got out of China were the moment where 27 member states were behind the president of the Commission and the president of the Council to exert leverage. We did not manage to reach the comprehensive agreement on investment because we had a mandate and because everything was smooth. We managed because 27 member states leveraged China. I'm not saying this is the climax, but this is certainly a moment where we leveraged China at our best. When we got some concession on technology transfer, this was the same. We had 27 member states behind us. So it's not that I want coordination between member states because I think coherence is a nice thing. It's just when you deal with China, you want to build leverage, you want to build credibility because this is the only language China understands. And for that, you need 27 member states behind you. And this is why I think it's the strength of Europe to have this 27 different relationship. It's also a constraint because it's a very difficult setup to deal with as compared to the US, you know. Often we compare our policy vis-a-vis the US, but the US government is one.
I fully agree that we always cherish our diversity. It's great. I think within Europe, it's a plus. But when it comes to relations with the rest of the world, it's much harder. And especially for countries which operate very centrally, you know, like if you had a country where, you know, you can have multiple relations on the other side, then it would be easier. But this is certainly not China. So for China, our diversity becomes a problem, clearly. And some member states may think they profit from this because they can squeeze in, but at the end of the day, it doesn't help anybody because their leverage is so much smaller. So for member states to understand that only EU-level leverage works for a country of the size of China with a political and economic model like that of China, that's, I think, the way forward. If I were running this commission, I would try very hard to make anybody, including the largest country in Europe, understand that they're too small for China. And making examples of how many times they have to backtrack on what they want is the way to go. I mean, it's like, in a way, sorry to say, shaming by naming, in the sense, making it clear to any EU member state that there's nothing to gain with this at the end of the game. Yeah, that's what I would do if I were the commission, to make it bluntly clear that nobody's big enough in the EU for China.
When it comes to other big players in the world, we cannot not mention that the upcoming US elections. Do you think that the next US admission, whether who wins in the end, will this have an influence on EU-China relations?
And the first thing to note is that the things are changing as we speak, you know, not only on the probability of Trump winning the elections, it seems, but also we just had this major speech by Kamala Harris, and we don't really know what she thinks about China compared to Biden. I mean, quite frankly, let alone Taiwan. I mean, it's a very, very different ballgame. I think it's smart of her side to not. But the reality is that it might not be tactical. It might be for real. So we don't really know, because we have this big question mark. What does Kamala Harris want from China? I actually think Biden's policies on China were very personal, very, very ideological. I mean, you could see, especially on Taiwan, it was very obvious compared to even his team. So now the question is, where are we? We don't really know. And there's also a lot of disagreement as to what China wants also. Not that China can influence that, or so we hope, but it makes also a difference because it's a combination of the two, yeah? I mean, who wins and what's China's expected reaction? For Europe, for me, it's quite clear. We're not Singapore, we're Europe, yeah? Meaning we are a major economy in the world. We need to have our own ideas, no matter who wins, for God. By the way, we can't even figure out what's going to happen. So if we have to stop a new commission from thinking about China just because we have U.S. elections, it demonstrates, it in a way, it proves our weakness. And only a very small country all alone, I mentioned Singapore, can afford this, but we're not on that boat. Therefore, it is very important that we create a strategy independently on these elections, because we were a bloc and we have to have our own policies, frankly. So for me, we shouldn't hide behind the bush waiting for November rather than thinking what to do about our relations with China.
I think China is waiting as well for the elections to adjust its policy. And I agree with Alicia in the sense that we shouldn't wait for the US to basically develop its own thinking for what it wants out of China. Because if we do that, then yes, we do lose what does the EU want, where are the EU interests. But equally, we need to take into account the fact that China is going to change and adjust its policy vis-a-vis Europe after November. And in that sense, started thinking for us about what we want is also going to avoid ourselves to get derailed by China's foreign policy adjustment. Because while we can expect the US to continue its foreign policy adjustment when it comes to China, something we have seen through Biden, this has been a very in a way, the first sense for Europe about what it's going to mean in the Indo-Pacific for the next 5 years. We have experienced what it means to see the Americans putting economic interests first and foremost when it comes to dealing with China. We will see that more. So we do need to get ready for this idea that the US is going to adjust its policy vis-a-vis China in the next mandate. And it's going to create even more tension between the EU and the US when it comes to dealing together with China. This is not irreconcilable, but this is going to be there. But China is equally going to change its approach. And I think the most interesting part is how will China readjust its policy if we have a Trump administration or if we have a Kamala Harris administration? And at this stage, they're saying that regardless of the results, it doesn't matter. Actually, it does matter, and it's going to matter for Europe.
And when that actually happens, I'm sure we'll come back to use another episode to discuss this matter in full extent. So my last question to both of you, what are your recommendations to the new EU leadership?
So I can tell you, when we started this paper with Alicia, we had an entire Christmas list, the shopping list. But I think I'm going to focus on 3 points. The first is going to be about building a more comprehensive approach to China. In that sense, I mean that we do need member states, but we equally need companies on board. For instance, this understanding of risks and resilience, this discussion, we do need to have them with companies. Without them, our China strategy is not going to work. Equally, we need to explain to citizens why China is going to be left, right, and center in the press, while some goods that they used to buy in the supermarket are going to cost maybe a bit more. And why is that? And this idea that we need to explain China to our citizens for them to understand that there will be a cost to what is going to happen, I think for me that's essential. And with that is going to come this question of, are we capable enough in Europe? So we also need to train our citizens, because right now our China capability is not sufficient in Europe for what's coming next. So that's my first point. My second point is, the last Commission mandate started with this idea that values have become a horizontal issue with China across the relationship impacting trade. This was new, this idea that human rights mattered in the trade and economic relations with China. This was completely new at the beginning of the last Commission. This Commission, the new keyword is going to be security. And this is not a word that Brussels like very much because of divisions of competence between member states and the Commission. But the conversation for this Commission is going to be about European security. And we are going to have this conversation on European security coming from the US, coming from China, coming from Russia, is going to be left, right, and center. And we need to digest the fact that security will need to be accepted, will need to be a term that the Commission deals with, will need to be a term where member states are leaving some extra, probably, competence or room for maneuver from the Commission, and we will have to start bringing NATO into the equation when dealing with that. And finally, my last point, when I'm thinking about the recommendation to the new leadership, is the question of the global south. And this was a question that emerged with the COVID pandemic, with the war in Ukraine. But I think we have reached that point where there is an urgency to deal with the global south, and especially in this idea of competing with China, because it's going to matter for our companies in third markets. It's going to matter for the European global footprint in the world. And if we do not get this conversation on the global south, if Europe does not have an offer that is effective, we have an offer, but an effective one, I think Europe is not going to be the global player that we want it to become.
Alicia, the floor is yours.
Well, I think Abigail said it all. I can only add, you know, tiny economic bites to this music, which I fully agree with. I would insist on the third because it's related. Basically, for an economic bloc like Europe, we're the largest exporter in the world. People think it's China. No, it's us. We forget that. when you put the whole of the EU together. And we have shrinking population, China does too, but the point is, for our companies, our market is a shrinking market. We need to realize that. This means the rest of, and by the way, China is an even faster shrinking market than us because their imports are literally collapsing. So China is, in a way, vanishing as this El Dorado of our companies, and they know that in and out. Many are trapped there because they've invested humongously. But the reality is they know that's not the future. That's not a growth market. We're not a growth market. Where is the rest of the growth market? The U.S. The U.S. is a growth market. That's why companies are going to the U.S. The U.S. even pays you to go there in some cases. But generally, it's a difficult but a growth market, population-wise, in many ways. But the most obvious growth market is, of course, India, Southeast Asia, you know. We cannot miss that boat. I mean, it's very obvious. But for that competition with China, and this brings me to the competition versus rivalry, to be decent, we need some set of rules that allows us to compete in those third markets. And this is the key, and I want to only make this point. Our defensive toolkit is about us. It doesn't really protect us in third markets. So we need to find a way to help our companies, and this is about our welfare and everything that Abigail started with. We want to keep our status we need to make sure that those markets are not given away. So for that, our current toolkit, even our economic security strategy, is about us, which is great, but it's not enough. So developing that angle of the rest of the world is essential. It's essential. We need to find a way to keep those markets open to us, not to allow those markets to be, in some cases, even captive markets for China. So that thing is a must for an economic bloc like Europe, not the U.S., because the U.S. is, in a way, in the best sense of the world, self-reliant. They have the market, they have the size. We are not in that situation. So let's not wait for the elections. We have different problems that we need to deal with right now.
This has been a great conversation. I am Yuyun Jan, and I'm with Alicia Garcia Herrero from Bruegel and Abigail Basilier from Merix. We look forward to this upcoming paper. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show next time. Bye-bye.